poetry has existed mainly in a confused conflict between two styles, the loose, idiomatic line of Whitman and the traditional, measured line of English poetry. In recent years, to many poets, neither of these styles has seemed functional. We have become aware, I think, of our provincial neglect of other great poetic traditions, particularly the colloquial understatement of Oriental poetry and the direct sensuous imagery of Spanish and Latin American poetry. Particularly in the Midwest and the Far West, younger poets have felt the need to experiment with new rhythms and images of spatial tension that have no superimposed metaphors, as in traditional English poetry. Recently, our guest today has been a leader in the attempt to claim for American poetry the kind of imagery that is an imagery of sensuous, suggestive notation rather than explicit intellectual metaphorical comparison. Mr. Wright's recent book, The Branch Will Not Break, was a complete departure from his previous, more traditional rhetorical style, and he received a great deal of acclaim for his courage in grappling with a new style. I'm very glad to welcome James Wright to the Poetry Center's 10th anniversary series.
Thank you, and thank you for inviting me. What do you like? I want to begin by saying some poems that I like. Can you all hear me? Come again? Fine. I want to say some poems that I like very much, and I don't care why. Yes, I know why, but I don't care why. This is in the Irish, not the Irish, but the Oxford, no, the Irish thing will come up later. No, let me follow my mind. Irish. The yellow bittern that never broke out in a drinking bout might as well have drunk. His bones are thrown on a naked stone where he lives alone like a hermit monk. Oh, yellow bittern, I pity your lot, though they say that a sot like myself is cursed. I was sober a while, but I'll drink and be wise, for fear I should die in the end of thirst. It's not for the common birds that I'd mourn, the blackbird, the corncrake, or the crane, but for the bittern that shy and apart where he drinks in the marsh from the long bog drain. Oh, if I heard you were near your death while my breath held out, I'd have run to you. Till a splash from the lake of the son of the bird your soul would have stirred and waked anew. My darling said I should drink no more, or my life should be o'er in a little short while. For I said, 'tis the drink gives me health and strength, and will lengthen my road by many a mile. You see how the bird with the long, smooth neck could catch his death of the thirst at last. Come, soul of my soul, and drain your cup. You'll get no sup when your life is past. In a wintering island by Constantine's halls, a bittern calls from a wineless place, and tells me that hither he cannot come till the summer is here and the sunny days. When he crosses the stream there and wings o'er the sea, then a fear comes to me he may fail in his flight. Well, the milk and the ale are drunk every drop, and a dram won't stop our thirst this night. Thomas McDonough wrote that. The Johnny Bulls took or fixed his wagon in 1916. This is out of the Oxford Dictionary of Nursery Rhymes by Iona, thank you, and Peter Opie. You remember the children have their own enormous tradition of great literature, and we can be reminded of this weird thing by real poetry. We forget it when we're about 5 or 6 years old, but who remembers it then? Someone hands it on. I in spells in. I was in my kitchen doing a bit of stitching. Old Father Nimble came and took my thimble. I got a great big stone, hit him on the belly bone. O-U-T spells out. With Mr. Lindenthal, I just saw the, a little while ago, saw the film about my beloved old teacher, Theodore Retke. He taught me that. I can't resist one more. That he didn't teach me, but that he taught me about Stanley Kunitz. And Stanley Kunitz read this to me out of a notebook one evening. You know, old nursery rhyme. There was a lady loved a swine. Honey, quoth she, Pigog, wilt thou be mine? Ugh, quoth he. I'll build thee a silver sty, honey, quoth she, and in it thou shalt lie. Ugh, quoth he, pinned with a silver pin, honey, quoth she, that thou may go out and in. Ugh, quoth he, wilt thou have me now? Honey, quoth she, speak or my heart will break. Quoth he. Oh, my. This is by Henry Howard, Earl of Surrey. Surrey fought against the Belgians in some stupid war. They're all stupid. And he was lying wounded between the British breastworks and the breastworks of the Belgians. You can look it up. That's what they call them. And his squire, a kid named Thomas Clare, ran out to bring him back and brought him back in his arms. And Clare was shot. Surrey recovered. He took Clare back to England. And Clare suffered all the way through the winter and died. Clare had been betrothed to a girl named Anne Shelton. Surrey wanted to do something noble, to respond to the nobility of this action. It is noble. Did anybody ever save your life? It is noble. And the word noble is not meaningless. He wrote a sonnet that he had carved on the wall in one part of the family mausoleum, the Surrey family. Surrey was an aristocrat. Epitaph for Thomas Clare. Norfolk sprung thee, Lambeth holds thee dead. Clare of the county of Claremont, though hight. Within the womb of Ormond's race thou bred, and sawest thy cousin crowned in thy sight. Shelton for love, Surrey for lord thou chase. Ay me, whilst life did last, that league was tender. tracing whose steps thou sawest Kelso blaze, Londesey burnt, and battered Bullen render. At Muttrell gates, hopeless of all recure, thine earl, half dead, gave in thy hand his will, which cause did thee this pining death procure, ere summers 4 times 7 thou couldst fulfill. Ah, Clare, if love had booted care or cost, heaven had not won, nor earth so timely lost. Now listen. Reconciliation, do you know? Reconciliation. Out of drum taps. We think of poets being apart in time and in place, in language. Reconciliation. Word over all, beautiful as the sky. Beautiful that war and all its deeds of carnage must in time be utterly lost. That the hands of the sisters, death and night, incessantly, softly wash again and ever again this soiled world. For my enemy is dead. A man, divine as myself, is dead. I look where he lies, white-faced and still in the coffin. I draw near, bend down, and touch lightly with my lips the white face in the coffin. And there you have the Earl of Surrey and Walt Whitman. E.A. Robinson did not include in his collected poems a little poem that appeared in The Torrent and The Night Before. It's called To Walt Whitman. I think that it's probably a good thing that he didn't include that little poem, because that makes it too easy. He and Whitman are very close together, and poetry is not a matter of metrical gimmicks. Here are two poems, one by Whitman and one by Robinson. Whitman, out of the rolling ocean, the crowd came a drop gently to me, whispering, I love you. Before long I die, I have traveled a long way merely to look on you, to touch you, for I could not die till I once looked on you, for I feared I might afterward lose you. Now we have met, we have looked, we are safe. Return in peace to the ocean, my love. I too am part of that ocean, my love. We are not so much separated. Behold the great rondure, the cohesion of all. How perfect! But as for you, for me, the irresistible sea is to separate us, as for an hour, carrying us diverse, yet cannot carry us diverse forever. Be not impatient. A little space. No, you, I salute the air, the ocean, and the land every day at sundown for your dear sake, my love. I don't know if you read Captain Craig anymore, but when the young college boys come in Tilbury Town, which is in Gardner, Maine, and ask the town bum, Captain Craig, they call him, to account for himself, he has something to say. He lives on the edge of town, and he is indigent, he's well educated, He answers them when they ask, how can you be old and broken and defeated and unsuccessful and be so happy? State your business. And he answers with a spring poem. It comes in that long blank verse thing. I cannot think of anything today that I would rather do than be myself. Primevally alive. And have the sun shine into me. For on a day like this, when chaff parts of a man's adversities are blown by quick spring breezes out of him, and even a flicker of wind that wakes no more than a tuft of grass or a few young yellow leaves comes like the falling of a prophet's breath on altar flames rekindled of crushed embers, now do I feel within me no dreariness, no grief, no discontent, no twinge of human envy. But I beg that you forego credentials of the past for these illuminations of the present, or better still, to give the shadow justice, you let me tell you something. I have yearned through many another season for these days, and having them with God's own pageantry to make me glad for them, yes, I have cursed the sunlight and the breezes and the leaves to think of men on stretchers or on beds or on foul floors, things without shapes or names, made human with paralysis and rags, or some poor devil on a battlefield, left undiscovered and without the strength to drag a maggot from his clotted mouth, of women working where a man would fall, flat-breasted, miracles of cheerfulness made neuter by the work that no man counts until it waits undone. Children thrown out to feed their veins and souls on garbage. Yes, I have had half a mind to blow my brains out sometimes. And I have gone from door to door, ragged myself, trying to do something. Crazy, I hope. But what has this to do with spring? Oh my. I must have stolen that 25 times anyway. No. John Ransom taught that to us. John Ransom. I saw him last Christmas with my brother. We went up to see him. His hair is white. He's younger than we were. He gets younger all the time. Do you know his poems? Winter Remembered. Two evils, monstrous, either one apart, possessed me and were long and loath at going. A cry of absence, absence in the heart, and in the wood the furious winter blowing. Think not when fire was bright upon my bricks, and past the tight boards hardly a wind could enter, I glowed like them, the simple burning sticks. Far from my cause, my proper heat and center. Better to walk forth in the murderous air and wash my wound in the snows. That would be healing, because my heart would throb less painful there, being caked with cold and past the smart of feeling. And where I went, the hugest winter blast would have this body bowed, these eyeballs streaming. And though I think this heart's blood flowed not fast, it ran too small to spare one drop for dreaming. Dear love, these fingers that have known your touch and tied our separate forces first together were 10 poor idiot fingers, not worth much, 10 frozen parsnips hanging in the weather. Old Pappy, wonderful man. One more, I think. H.R. Hayes, whom I've never met, has made beautiful translations of some South American poems. And this is a poem in his translation from the Spanish of Pablo Neruda. I just had a telegram about a week and a half ago from my my old friend Robert Bly, and I had written to him, and he was glad to hear from me. I had written for some time, and he was beside himself, and he said, Neruda just walked in. He's in Paris. And he sent me a telegram. Good. It made me happy, too. It's as if a mountain had walked in to me. It's wonderful. Walking around. It so happens, I am tired of being a man. It so happens, going into tailor shops and movies, I am withered, impervious, like a swan of felt navigating a water of beginnings and ashes. The smell of barber shops makes me weep aloud. All I want is a rest from stones or wool. All I want is to see no more establishments or gardens, no merchandise or goggles or elevators. It so happens I am sick of my skin and my nails and my hair and my shadow. It so happens I am tired of being a man. Yet it would be delicious to frighten a notary with a cut lily. Wouldn't it? To do somebody to death with a box on the ear. It would be fine going through the streets with a green knife, letting out yells until I died of cold. I do not want to go on being a root in the darkness, vacillating, spread out, shivering with sleep downwards in the drenched guts of the earth, absorbing and thinking, eating every day. I do not want so many afflictions. I do not want to go on being root and tomb, being alone underground, being a vault for dead men, numb with cold, dying of anguish. That is why Monday, I finally figured out Monday, that's the day you go back to work. Now listen, that is why Monday blazes like petroleum when it sees me coming with my jailbird face, and it howls like a wounded wheel as it passes and takes hot-blooded steps towards night. And it shoves me into certain corners, into certain damp houses, into hospitals where the bones fly out of the window, into certain shoe shops with a stench of vinegar, into streets as frightful as chasms. There are sulfur-colored birds and horrible intestines hanging from the doors of the houses that I hate. There are false teeth forgotten in a coffee pot. Parenthetically, T.S. Eliot should live so long. There are false teeth forgotten in a coffee pot. There are mirrors that ought to have wept for shame and fear. There are umbrellas all over and poisons and navels. I walk with composure, with fury, with forgetfulness, with eyes, with shoes on. I cross, I pass by offices and orthopedic shoe shops into patios where the wash hangs from the wires, under drawers, towels, and shirts that weep slow, filthy tears. Oh. pause 1 second. My first book, let me say a poem, the very last poem in the book, is about my grandmother, whom I love very much. I asked her if she would help me to write an excuse when I played hooky one afternoon in the spring back in Martins Ferry, Ohio. I was a young punk. I was in the third grade. And I wouldn't ask my parents. I asked my grandmother, who was on the side of the angels. She was the angel of the angels, the Miss Lonely Hearts of Miss Lonely Hearts. Love that. And I had planned to spend the whole afternoon in the boondocks behind Martins Ferry out in the hills, fooling around, doing nothing. But we devoted 2.5 hours to the achievement of a version of the excuse that I was to turn over to Mr. Ralph H. Dennis. Where are you, Ralph? No. Can you hear me? You know. Hello out there. Here's what we achieved. And I had my hands up over the edge of the table listening. She was so great. Old Biddy Lyons. Dear Mr. Dennis, please excuse Jimmy for being absent from school. He had to go to the eye specialist. S-P-A-C-H-L-U-S-A-L-U-S-T. That's it. But I adored her forever. And she has the last poem in my first book, the first poem in my second book. She is right in dead center in my third book. And right at the moment, I'm trying to figure a better place. Is there some better place? She's wonderful. She's been dead for a long time, and she's very old when she died, and I was just a little kid. When I came back from Europe to study, after studying a year at the University of Vienna, my parents had moved from Warnock, Ohio, up to Chandlersville to a big new farmhouse, and I was going up the stairs. The new farmhouse had one of those old winding things. You go up the third floor, and I was going around the bend of the stair, and I came on the picture, a lovely girl, this very young face. Who is that? My God, I said. My mother wouldn't tell me for a long time. That's Grandma, she said. Bothered me for years after this. And I thought, finally, when I was reading Augustine in his very sophistic but convincing demonstration that eternity and time are not the same, if Grandma's ghost would come back, why should she have to come back as an old woman? Why shouldn't she come as a young woman? Why not? Why not indeed? And the poem, it takes some footnote, doesn't it? I like her better than I do the poem. That's why I talk so long about it. I imagine her coming out of the old Weak Cemetery back on the other side of Coleraine, Ohio, crossing the road there. I had a job in a farm near there once when I was about 10 years old. She's coming across the road and out of the trees up to a farm that used to be owned by my uncle. She skimmed the... It's a sonnet. It looks like one anyway. She skimmed the yellow water like a moth, trailing her feet across the shallow stream. She saw the berries, paused and sampled them, where a slight spider cleaned his narrow tooth. Light in the air, she fluttered up the path, so delicate to shun the leaves and damp, like some young wife lifting her slender lamp to find her stray child, or the moon, or both. Even before she reached the empty house, she beat her wings ever so lightly, rose, followed a bee where apples blew like snow, and then, forgetting what she wanted there, too full of blossom and green light to care She hurried to the ground and slipped below. Out of St. Judas, the second book. No, I can't remember. A friend of mine suggested that I call the book after this, St. Judas Meets the Wolf Man. No, this is from St. Judas itself. This is about a man named Mr. Blue Heart, who owned an apple orchard right outside Martins Ferry, Ohio, and he had a sign up that said, "Shotgun Law, pray as you enter." And it never occurred to me until I came to write that second book that he knew perfectly well that that sign was an invitation. And it was wonderful to realize that he got it, you know. He got it long before I did. But of course, it's an invitation to little boys to come in and steal his apples, and in a way we satisfied him. But it made me sorry, too, because we used to bug him in certain ways. It would get on his nerves. And there's a little poem I have in the book St. Judas called An Offering for Mr. Blueheart. I'll go back there sometime. I haven't been back yet. I'd like to go back and sort of see that place. That was a place when I was young where two or three good friends and I tested the fruit against the tongue or through the withered windfalls by. The sparrows, angry in the sky, denounced us from a broken bough. They limp along the wind and die. The apples all are eaten now. Beyond the orchard, past one hill, the lean, satanic owner lay and threatened us with murder till we stole his riches all away. He damned us in the act one day and damned us to the laughing bone, and fired his gun across the gray autumn where now his life is done. Sorry for him or any man who lost his labored life to thieves. Today I mourn him as I can by leaving in their golden leaves some luscious apples overhead. Now may my abstinence restore peace to the orchard and the dead. We shall not nag them anymore. Out of St. Judas, a poem called A Note Left in Jimmy Leonard's Shack. Now, this poem is a lie because, well, it's based on a real experience. Do you remember in Thus Spake Zarathustra? Nietzsche, the Zarathustra's students come up and say, "Meister, was haben Sie über die Dichter zu sagen?" "What do you have to say about poets, master?" And he answers, "Die dichten zu viel." It's wonderful. They lie too much. "But isn't Zarathustra a poet?" And he answers, "All right, I lie too much." "Very well, I lie too much." All right. This poem is a lie. It's based on a real experience and a real person. There was an old guy named Francis Leonard. He had gone to Ohio State. When I was a kid, I thought that was admirable, and that the poem came out of that feeling. If I heard that now, God, it's the last thing on earth I would do. Well, you know what I mean. But it was very impressive. And he stood wearing his overalls that were too big, and he was constantly drunk. And the only thing I ever heard him say, and as far as I know, the only thing anyone ever heard him say was, "God bless my soul. God bless my soul. God bless my soul. God bless my soul. God bless my soul," he would say, over and over. And that's all. One night, two friends and I found him standing down near Etneyville, Ohio. The word Etneyville doesn't mean anything to you. It sure does to me. That's the place where the carnivals used to come. I saw a geek there. Have you ever seen a geek? One of the last of the geeks. Anyway, Minigan was down near there, and it was snowing. It was starting to snow, and we just felt we ought to take him home. We were slightly afraid of his brother Jimmy, and they lived on top of a hill. But it was a decent thing to do, and I'm awfully glad we did it. He would have made his way home alone anyway, but we were about 10 years old, and I've done so many things I'm ashamed of. I'm not ashamed of that. Anyway, we took him home, helped him get up there. And his brother Jimmy opened the door and said, "Thank you, boys." "Okay, good night, Jimmy," we said. I've kept that experience to myself. The poem has a little boy speaking. He's about 12 years old, I imagine. What I was trying to do was swear, to see if it was possible to swear in a poem. I'd been reading a number of American poems that blundered into a horrible principle. The principle by which the force of swear words declines insofar as one uses swear words excessively. As in the army, you've been in the army, and you know that you use all sorts of four-letter words simply as musical notations. You know, in ordinary domestic situations, it's true. Remember, when you're in chow, you think of the meal, "Pass me the butter." Everybody knows that. "Pass me the butter." But then what happens when you really need to swear? And human beings desperately need to swear. What happens then? I met a couple of geniuses. And in the army, who, thrown back on their invention, I know this is a tape, but I'm going to say it because Mac W. Patrick from Crafton, Alabama, said to me, "I come from so far back in the country, they have to fan the coon farts out of the kitchen to keep from making ringtail biscuits." You think Shakespeare wouldn't have stolen that? Well, let me tell you something. He stole it. He stole it. Plenty of times. He stole it when he had Falstaff look off stage in the second part of Henry IV, and Justice Shallow, who has just been boasting about what a gay blade he was among the prostitutes at the Lincoln's Inn Fields Law School 50 years before. "Oh," he said, "I was charming, wasn't I, Sir John?" He goes off stage and Falstaff says, "When he was naked among the whores, he looked for all the world like a forked radish with a head fantastically carved upon it with a knife." The same language. Well, I wanted to learn how to swear with force again, and so I imagined with Minigan, this 12-year-old boy, leaving a note to Jimmy as they took Minigan home. And he writes, "Near the dry water, or near the dry river's watermark, we found your brother, Minigan, stretched like a fish against the muddy ground. Beanie, the kid whose yellow hair turns green, told me to find you, even in the rain, and tell you he was drowned. I hid behind the chassis on the bank, the wreck of someone's Ford. I was afraid to come and wake you drunk. You told me once that waking up was hard, the daylight beating at you like a board. Blood in my stomach sank. Besides, you told him never to go out along the river's side, drinking and singing, clattering about. You might have thrown a rock at me and cried I was to blame. I let him fall in the road and pitch down on his side. Well, I'll get hell enough when I get home for coming up this far, leaving this note and running as I came. I'll go and tell my father where you are. You better go find Minigan before policeman here and come. Beanie went home and I got sick and ran. You old son of a bitch. You better hurry down to Minigan. He's drunk or dying now, I don't know which. Rolled in the roots and garbage like a fish. The poor old man. I should have admitted also that Ring Lardner is a little behind that. Do you ever read a caddy's diary? That boy is 12 years old. And the boy tells you how he has a job as a caddy. He goes cadding, he says. There's a beautiful woman named Mrs. Doan. And, And Mrs. Carter is ugly. But he lets Mrs. Doan cheat, and he says in his diary, Mrs. Carter is an ugly dame with things on her face, and it sure must make Mr. Doan feel sore when he sees he married Mrs. Carter, but then I suppose she could not all have married the same one. And besides, Mr. Doan, who she did marry, ain't such a hell of a man himself, though dirty with money. Kind of beauty. It's not like Bach. Ring Lardner. This is the last poem I'll say out of St. Judas. It's the poem called St. Judas. Let's just assume that I've called it a poem about Judas, not St. Judas. Let's not get into that again. Some of my best friends are Roman Catholics, and we have this all the time. I curse the day that Judas was born, not necessarily because he betrayed Christ, but because he tricked me into concocting the title St. Judas, which leads me into theological disputes. Judas. What I was actually trying to do, once again, was something technical. I wanted to write a dramatic monologue that was a sonnet. And it sounds horrible, but it's really true. When I went out to kill myself, I caught a pack of hoodlums beating up a man. Running to spare his suffering, I forgot my name, my number, how my days began, how soldiers milled around the garden stone and sang amusing songs. How all that day their javelins measured crowds. How I alone bargained the proper coins and slipped away. Banished from heaven, I found this victim, beaten, stripped, kneed, and left to cry. Dropping my rope aside, I ran, ignored the uniforms. Then I remembered bread my flesh had eaten, the kiss that ate my flesh. Flayed without hope, I held the man for nothing in my arms. Pause just 1 second again. The first poem in my book, The Branch Will Not Break, refers to an ancient Chinese governor. This ancient Chinese governor is, I'm sure many of you who have looked at this poem recognize immediately, is Spa Chui, one of the great poets of the Tang Dynasty. And one of the very happy things that have happened to me in the past two or three years has been my discovery of the poetry of Arthur Whaley, who is a very, very beautiful poet, and there it is. It took me a long time to find him, but I did. And he translated a good many of the poems of Bao Chui, who is a government official, like many poets, and even greater poets like Tu Fu, is called by Kenneth Rexroth the greatest non-dramatic poet in any language. And as far as Mr. Rexroth's own translations are concerned, I think I would agree. Those are sublime. I suppose you all know that 100 poems in the Chinese that has 30 poems of Tu Fu translated by Kenneth Rexroth. They're extraordinary, extraordinarily beautiful in the English language. But Ba Chui comes to us through Arthur Whaley. And the first poem in my book, The Branch Will Not Break, I meant literally as a kind of tribute to him. I didn't know about him. I do know now. I'm awfully glad. The poem is called As I Step Over a Puddle at the End of Winter. I think of an ancient Chinese governor. Po Chui, at one point in his career, was trying to get up the Yangtze River between political administrations. It throws me, I don't understand the intricacies of it, but I don't know what's happening in Vietnam either. I can't even find out from Henry Luce. I mean this very simply. I don't know what is happening. For all I know, I'm in favor of defoliating Ho Chi Minh. Why not? But I don't even know what. If only I knew what was happening there. But I don't understand the intricacy of the political situation 1,000 years ago in China, either around the great city Chang'an. But, as we say, I've been there before. I know he had to get out of town and get up the river. And he was going across a rope bridge. And he looked down and he said to himself, you know, he's between two cliffs. Way, way down. He looked into the gorge and the wind is swaying him back and forth. And he says, I know. Well, he starts to pray and refer to certain ancient sacred scriptures, and he refers in his own mind to a couple of saints and sages who have been in similar plight and who've died. They died. He looks down and says, and how can I, born in evil days and fresh from failure, ask a kindness of fate? He had been told if he got to the town of Chuko and he could meet a boat there, he could get upstream in time to get a new political job. And he arrived on time. And what happened? The wind was blowing in the wrong direction. And it blowed for 10 days and he sat there. Did you ever hear the joke? You know this punchline? And you're going to make trouble for me. You know that? Everybody knows a version of that joke. The man stumbles over your feet and you say, get out of here, buddy, or I'm going to make trouble for you. And he turns and smiles calmly and says, I've got varicose veins. I am carrying on one arm my twin children, whose pants need changed. My wife has just run off with the mailman. My daughter has gonorrhea. My son has buboes. God cursed me from the bottom of his heart, and the devil invited me to be the secretary treasurer next year of the Benevolent and Protective Order of Elks, and you're going to make trouble for me. No, wait. Wait. I'm just fooling around. I'm trying to lead up to the poem. Listen what Ba Chui wrote. 10 days. White billows and huge waves block the river crossing. This is Ba Chui, incidentally. I'm still leading up to my own poem. White billows and huge waves block the river crossing. Wherever I go, danger and difficulty. Whatever I do, failure. Just as in my worldly career I wander and lose the road, So when I come to the river crossing, I am blocked by contrary winds of fishes and prawns sodden in the rain. The smell fills my nostrils with the sting of insects that come with the fog. My whole body is sore. I am growing old. Time flies past, and my short span of life runs out while I sit in a boat at Chuco, wasting 10 days. Stumptown, Iowa, you know. Why not? Well, here's my poem. I knew how he felt, and I wanted to begin my new book by invoking his spirit to bless me, if possible. I needed it. As I step over a puddle at the end of winter, I think of an ancient Chinese governor, and then there's the epigraph written in 819 A.D. And how can I, born in evil days and fresh from failure, ask a kindness of fate? Botchui, balding old politician, what's the use? I think of you uneasily entering the gorges of the Yangtze when you were being towed up the rapids toward some political job or other in the city of Chungshou. You made it, I guess, by dark. But it is 1960. It is almost spring again, and the tall rocks of Minneapolis build me my own black twilight of bamboo ropes and waters. Where is Yuan Chen, the friend you loved? Where is the sea that once solved the whole loneliness of the Midwest? Where is Minneapolis? I can see nothing but the great terrible oak tree darkening with winter. Did you find the city of isolated men beyond mountains? Or have you been holding the end of a frayed rope for 1,000 years? Let me try it. I have another little gimmick that I employ in my own books. These are secrets of my own. A poet who came to mean so much to me when I was a young punk, Goethe. And he wrote in the midst of this long poem, Hearts That Eyes Im Winter, three stanzas that Brahms selected and used as the text for his alto rhapsody. Aber abseits verist ins Gebüsch verliert sich sein Pfad, hinter ihm schlagen die Sträucher zusammen. Das Gras steht wieder auf, die Erde verschlingt ihn. Ach, wer heilet die Schmerzen des dem Balsam zu Gift war? Der sich Menschenhass aus der Fülle der Liebe trank, erst verachtet, nun ein Verächter, zehrt er heimlich auf seinen eigenen Wert in ungnügender Selbstsucht. Ist auf deinem Zalter, Vater der Liebe, ein Ton seinem Ohre vernehmlich? Seinem Ohre vernehmlich. I had to look at the English. Öffne den umwölkten Blick über die tausende Quellen neben dem Durstenden in der Wüste. Now, I have this poem, three stanzas from Goethe. That man standing there, who is he? His path lost in the thicket. Behind him, the bushes lash back together. The grass rises again. The waste devours him. Oh, who will heal the sufferings of the man whose balm turned poison, who drank nothing but hatred of men from love's abundance. Once despised, now a despiser, he kills his own life, the precious secret. The self-seeker finds nothing. O Father of love, if your psaltery holds one tone, that his ear still might echo, then quicken his heart. Open his eyes, shut off by clouds from the thousand fountains, so near him, dying of thirst in his own desert. Let me read two brief poems from The Branch. Incidentally, I should mention that old classmates of mine, and Mark, I was mentioning how I was very good friends with certain people back at Kenyon 10 years ago. And they have a little gentleman's agreement. Every time I bring out a new book, there's immediately a competition that begins to see who can write the most effective parody of the title. And the winner... I write some horrible poem and present it to the winner. And Roger Hecht in New York calls this book The Branch Bank That I Broke Last Year and Other Rebels. I've never read these little ones before. Here, this is called Snowstorm in the Midwest. Though haunches of whales slope into white-capped doves, it is hard to drown here. Between two walls, a fold of echoes, a girl's voice walks naked. I step into the water of two flakes. The crowns of white birds rise to my ankles, to my knees, to my face. Escaping in silence from locomotive and smoke, I hunt the huge feathers of gulls and the fountains of hills. I hunt the sea to walk on the waters. A splayed starling follows me down a long stairway of white sand. Spring images. Two athletes are dancing in the cathedral of the wind. A butterfly lights on the branch of your green voice. Small antelopes fall asleep in the ashes of the moon. Milkweed. You remember the milkweed thing? It can be milkweed or dandelion. You know, you blow them, and there those parachutes go down. This was out on Robert Bly's farm. I was found milkweed. While I stood here in the open, lost in myself, I must have looked a long time down the corn rows beyond grass, the small house, white walls, animals lumbering toward the barn. I look down now. It is all changed. Whatever it was I lost, whatever I wept for, was a wild, gentle thing, the small dark eyes loving me in secret. It is here, at a touch of my hand, the air fills with delicate creatures from the other world. And I think I'll conclude with the poem called A Blessing. A friend of mine read this little poem, incidentally, to a class of his at the University of Minnesota, and a girl came up and said, I live on just off the highway to Rochester, Minnesota, and I own two ponies down there, and people better get the hell out of, you know, that's... Anyways. It really happened. It's horrible. We didn't sign it. A blessing. Just off the highway to Rochester, Minnesota, twilight bounds softly forth on the grass, and the eyes of those two Indian ponies darken with kindness. They have come gladly out of the willows to welcome my friend and me. We step over the barbed wire into the pasture where they have been grazing all day alone. They ripple tensely. They can hardly contain their happiness that we have come. They bow shyly as wet swans. They love each other. There is no loneliness like theirs. At home once more, they begin munching the young tufts of spring in the darkness. I would like to hold the slenderer one in my arms, for she has walked over to me and nuzzled my left hand. She is black and white. Her mane falls wild on her forehead, and the light breeze moves me to caress her long ear that is delicate as the skin over a girl's wrist. Suddenly I realize that if I stepped out of my body, I would break into blossom. Thank you.